This is CliffCentral.com.
A warm welcome to Global Leadership Platform, our leadership masterclass, Multiplying Leaders, Moving Society. That's what it's all about. I'm Adrian Groenewald, the old man not with me today. Of course, our website, leadershipplatform.com, one word, two P's in the middle. I'm excited about today's conversation. I've seen this leader from a distance do many things, and today he's going to share some of his thoughts and feelings about leadership and running an organization in very difficult times. I've got Dr. Jurrien Ferndale, CEO of JET at the moment in the Edcon Group, with me. We're sitting in one of his rooms at his offices. Jurrien, it's wonderful to be with you. How are you?
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you very much for the invite.
We're excited to have you talk about leadership and your views on leadership. I mean, you've had a long career, very much filled with glory days and tough days and everything. So we're excited about the next 40 minutes or so, and we appreciate your time. You seem to have a unique career. It's not obviously hugely unique, but I like the blend of you studied academically very, very effectively all the way to the highest level, if I can call it that. You've served in leadership positions in the HR field to the highest level of one of the biggest companies in the country, at least. You now also have served as a CEO of large business for a long time. I mean, incredible blend. Now, before we go to how that forms your leadership thinking, I'm interested in your background. Just very quickly, where did you grow up? What did you study? How did you end up with PhD? Let's just get that out of the way, but it is very important.
Oh, well, I think I most probably landed by default into the academic world because I grew up in a small little town, Graaf-Reinet, in the Eastern Cape, where my father was a carpenter, little small businessman, contractor type of person. And I only had a shop in Graaf-Reinet, and we also had sold a bit of vegetables and fruits and stuff like that, and walking, it's like outside of town. As you actually go into town, if you know Graaf-Reinet, as you go into town, you've got actually in those days, they actually had the black areas on the one side, and everyone must walk down through town. And every Saturday, I was there selling, potatoes and all sorts of other things. And I love that stuff. And every day after school, I was actually in the shop. Oh. So that's where my retail interests started. So it was quite clear to my father, certainly to me, that that's what I want to do, and I'm not going anywhere. So he cut that short very, very quickly by standard 9 at the time or so, and he said, "You're going to go and study." And I said, "No, I'm not going to study." He said, "Well, you will, because I'm closing the shop."
So you were happy to just keep selling and being in the business?
Yeah, because I love that stuff. And because every Saturday I was selling stuff, Sundays I went to farm selling my stuff, coming back with bringing wine bottles back. If people can't pay me with money, just take the wine bottles and sell the wine bottles type of thing. So I enjoyed that stuff, and you're young and you enjoy it, and you've got a bit of money as well. So I certainly had no intention to go and study. So I think it's also a bit of a message, I suppose, in terms of, especially for that generation, in terms of how important education was, because he didn't have the education, that he was prepared to, our lifeline in terms of our family, he was prepared to close that shop to get me to go to university. So, well, I didn't have then, I couldn't do that, so I just went to university and just studied, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do, because I didn't intend to go to university. So I did my first degree there, and luckily I did always well at school, and luckily I got a bursary from the UN Sciences Research Council, to do a degree in psychology and sociology and so on. So I did very well. I passed it cum laude, and they asked me to continue to do my honors degree in industrial psychology. Which I did, and then I came, because they gave me a bursary, I actually came back to Pretoria to work for them, and started immediately with my master's. I must be honest, I started to enjoy the the field and also the academics was actually more interesting than I thought. It was not as interesting as selling stuff, but every vocation I actually worked did some surveys, you know, because that's what they do. They do socioeconomic surveys and all sorts of other things. So I enjoyed doing those things, every vocation. So I was working every vocation. And then I completed my master's degree
in industrial psychology.
And I registered as an industrial psychologist and still registered today. Not so sure why, but maybe it's my back door. Because my daughters normally say, I'm not a good psychologist. I'll drive people to suicide if I need to counsel them. So, because I've never practiced. And then I also started to do my my doctorate, and also in human resources, industrial.
What was the thing? What did you do your doctorate?
Well, it was in the mid 80s.
This
is actually in the early 90s and so on. So, and I actually looked at, because with all the changes in South Africa, I looked at the role of trade unions in terms of politics. And that was quite interesting because I think there was a lot of things happening in South Africa at the time in terms of politics and so on. So I did an empirical investigation in terms of the role of unions, and one of my findings was that they actually have to play a political role based on the current circumstances that we actually had in the country.
And that sounds right.
It came out quite well. So I finished that, and then I actually started to work at the Human Science and Research Council. It was clearly not for me. I didn't think I was a researcher, so I did a couple of reports and stuff like that, but was not really what I wanted to do. So then I got offered a personnel officer position at the old ISCO at the time, which I sort of enjoyed because it gave me the more exposure in terms of what I was trained for. And then I also had my first exposure to industrial relations, which I liked based on my studies. I wanted to get involved with the union, so I was part of the teams there that negotiated with the unions, which was a great experience. And then after that, I actually left to South African Breweries. Actually, the person that worked with me at Human Sciences Research Council, he moved to South African Breweries as the consulting psychologist there. He recruited me to say, there's an assignment for equal opportunity manager or something like that. And that was also in the beginning of employment equity and equal opportunities and all of that. So it was quite actually interesting. And breweries, as you know, was at the forefront of of employment equity and equal opportunity. So I worked there for about 3 years or so, and I really enjoyed that. Learned a lot about what best practices in terms of performance management and all of those type of things.
It's a good environment to be in to learn best practices, I would say.
And certainly with employment equity. And then I actually spent about 5 years at a parastatal Transnet, one of the divisions, the Parcel Express division, but there was a general manager for HR for the entire division, about 10,000 people or so. And there I actually cut my teeth into union negotiations, because all the different divisions managed the unions differently, and also multiple unions, because there were like 3-4 different unions. And I actually really enjoyed that.
Did you ever run into Vic van Vieren?
Yes, Vic van Vieren recruited me.
Okay.
That's how the world works.
He was in the negotiations, very involved, at the height of his career.
He recruited me actually to Transnet at the time. And then after that, after about 5 years, I thought it was time to move on, and then I moved to Edcon, and that was a very interesting move for me. And I think when I spoke with Steve Ross at the time about the assignment, he asked me, what do I want? What is my expectations if I do to take up the assignment? I said, well, I want a line manager, a CEO that's really serious about people, because everyone says they're serious. And he asked me, what must he do to prove to me that he's serious about people management? I said, well, put 40% of the goals of the staff and line managers on people. And he said, why don't you do 50? And I thought, no, this must be the right place to be, because 50% of line managers' goals will be on people, on employment, equity, training, and all of those type of things. So I was really, I think I always said, I'm on record to say I was the luckiest HR director, most probably in South Africa, because I had a very supportive CEO that actually believed in HR things. And my job at the time was to get the company to become an employer of choice. And we actually achieved that within 3 years. We were the leading, the best company to work for in retail, and the top 20 best companies to work for in South Africa. So we maintained that over the next period of time until 2007, when Bain actually then moved in. And at that time, I thought it's time to do other things. And I was always very much interested in the business. I believe that I should be a business partner. As a business partner, you need to understand the numbers, etc. So, and Steve at the time and the other people could see that I had that interest. So they actually said, well, try operations, run operations. You centralize, because we centralized at the time all the HR fraternities, you know, from CNA and, and Edgar's, et cetera, CHIT. So we centralized the operations function, and they've asked me to run that. So that was quite interesting, because now I'm in the core of the business, I'm basically selling the stuff.
Back to your roots.
Back to my roots. And that was, it went on for about 3 or 4 years, and then there was a change in structure again, and they gave me HR back as well, in addition to operations, and they actually gave me property. So I became chief operating officer at the time. And that I enjoyed as well. And then Bernie actually joined later from Australia. He believed that we should decentralize things rather than centralize things. So we actually gave operations and all of those things back to the business. So I then was offered looking after the loyalty program, looking after Africa, looking after e-commerce, etc., which is also new and different. And I learned a lot about that. It was only about a year in that assignment, then the JET assignment came up. And I thought I can consolidate all of my experiences in running a fully-fledged P&L now.
Yeah.
And that's how I landed up where I am now. It's a interesting, long career.
I'm fascinated. Starting with selling potatoes and a small little retail store, in a small town, to ending up studying academically all the way to PhD, to a strong HR background, and then strong line leadership. I mean, all that together has to form your leadership philosophy and approach. And that's why I'm interested in what your thoughts are on the kind of leaders we need in today's corporate environment. I'm guessing there's a strong people element. I mean, all leaders say that. Some live it, some don't. But your philosophy, I think, was formed by all of this.
And I think my philosophy now today is largely influenced by actually what worked for us in the 2000s when we were a very successful company. And that's essentially started with a values-based leadership, values-based company. And that we pushed very hard then. And now that we're actually getting out of all the troubles that we actually have financially, we've actually started as a company to relaunch the values. And that's how we're actually going to drive the company to actually fundamentally change the culture of the company. And so I believe very firmly that you need to have sound values in a company, and it shouldn't just be something that's on a little board somewhere. People must believe in it, and they must know it. And then, more importantly, they need to understand what is the behavior supporting those values. And then something that I've toyed with for many years, even when I was in HR, and it was not that fashionable then, looks like more and more people starting to talk about that now, is the whole approach on concept of servant leadership. And again, it's one of those cliche words that people actually use. And but again, we've tried to implement that. And the essence of that is that, you know, as a leader, you actually need to actually have the ability to serve. You need to have the desire to serve. And I think that's not a typically the way that leaders think about themselves. You know,
some say that, but they just can't really behave that way.
And even you're right. And I think typically, and I don't think we're perfect. I think we're most probably 30% there. But I think the point is we're working on that, and that's a philosophy that we're communicating to our staff. So we and every single conference, and I've got every a quarterly conference now, and even in my previous job, I talk with all the store managers and the managers about leadership, about servant leadership, etc. Where they know very clearly that on top of the pyramid is actually not the CEO, it's actually the customer. And the second most important people after the customer is actually our sales associates. I'm here right in the bottom of my job is to support my direct reports, to roll obstacles out of their ways and help them to perform better. So every management level should support the next management level. In theory, it looks as if it's difficult, but it's a mindset issue. People actually just need to get their mind around it. That doesn't mean that you're disempowering yourself. You still have power because you own the strategy of the business. But in the final analysis, you need to serve. You need to actually have an attitude of serving, and that is it's very hard. It was very hard for me because when I started my HR journey, I must be honest, 20 years ago, I thought I know it all, like all the theoretical knowledge, I had competent people around me, but you know, I thought I know how to write a performance management system, and I just wrote the system. But I've got an OD manager that can write it. So you learn through years that you should actually empower people to do what they're supposed to do. But it sometimes comes with age. You know, I was very young when I completed my doctorate. And when I was in the most senior position here, and I think it's important that sometimes, hopefully, and that's what I'm trying to achieve with my people, is especially the young ones, don't make all the mistakes that I've made, and only 10 years later realize, but actually I should utilize my people better. I should actually empower them. I should actually serve them, etc.
In some ways, if you can get them at your young age that you were to see it. To some degree, how you see it now, then you're very successful as a leader.
Yeah.
Because then they build from there.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's part of a mission that I have at this stage in terms of what I want to achieve in my current assignment is to actually people to grasp the concept of servant leadership, grasp the fact that we should focus on the customer and actually work back from there. So, for instance, if you just look at one of our values, and I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about values, is empowerment. But we have empowered our staff as sales associate to do whatever they need to do to keep the customer happy. Whatever it costs, as long as the customer is happy and you've done something out of the ordinary and it's costing the company money, you will not be fired for that. Because the customer is the most important person, and it's the reason why we're in business. Now, people previously didn't have that type of authority. They actually, you know, would apologize. They would, they will not give the person a voucher or take the thing back because the rules say you can't bring certain things back. We said we want the customer to walk out there happy. So it doesn't matter what the rules say. Do whatever is necessary to make the customer happy.
Practically, I'm guessing that. Just a decree out there that says you've got all the power to make the customer happy. It doesn't just make everyone put their hands up and say yay, and then they do it. I mean, you've got to change your whole mindset.
Yeah, no, people actually don't.
They don't do it.
They don't do it. And I think it's even hard for us at senior management levels to do that because of also the different. Especially in the last 10 years where we were tight with money and all sorts of other things. And then we were also very admin-driven for a long period of time. And it's actually funny that you actually talk about the mindset stuff. And in our group CEO the other day, we had a meeting, and he said, to both me and Mike, Mike is the chief executive of Edgars, because we were battling to get some of things signed off in terms of following the processes to get to make our store smaller and put up walls and so on. And he said, stop with your slave mentality. You see, is just do it. If it's the right thing for the business, just do it. And I think that's... but the point is, you're so used to a different environment that you almost... The shackles is off, but you still operate as if the shackles are on.
It's because we're enslaved to structures and procedures and processes. We become a slave to that rather than the motivation of the business.
Exactly.
And do what's right for the business.
Yeah.
I want us to... We'll touch more on the values in a moment, because I wanted us to look at practically how you implement some of these values, and you're already there. But can we quickly stop unpacking or complete the unpacking of what a great and authentic leader is? So you've brought out some important points, values-driven. So if you had to say to me, a great and authentic leader needed in today's world would have to be values-driven. So values in my own life, but in my business. Servant, I'm a servant, I serve you, not you serve me. And if we can get every supervisor, every person who is promoted to a first supervisory position to make that decision there that I'm not going to be served now, I'm serving, we would do a good service to society. So servant leadership. What else would you put on top of that foundation of what a great and authentic leader is like and should be?
I think maybe we should look at what some of the characteristics of a servant leader. Mm. Because typically, if you're a servant leader, then you're less obsessed about yourself. You're actually there to ensure that the people that actually work for you, are, that their potential is actually potentialized. So you actually ensure that they are properly trained. You actually make sure that they actually achieve the best that they can be as individuals. My view is a good servant leader, and I think that's something that you will mostly hear all the time for general leaders, is to listen. I find it often when I was in operations that because I went to almost all our stores, if you're in stores, people listen to every word that you say. And we don't understand sometimes the impact that we have as senior leaders on people lower down in the organization. We people really put us on a pedestal. They think that we, you know, we...
More than human.
Yeah. And they can quickly sense when you don't, you're in a rush, you actually don't properly make eye contact. They talk, but you're thinking of looking at something else, etc. But if you make the time to listen... really listen to them, and when you actually go out of that store and promise them that they will actually get the stock that they actually requested in a certain size, and the next thing it does happen, you actually just build respect as well as a leader. Mm. You're actually not just there to quickly come and criticize the store. You're actually there to listen intentively to what they require. So I think that's important. As a leader, you need to be able to persuade people based on your logic and rational reasoning. And now, if you're a normal autocratic leader, you will actually use your power to actually persuade people. But if you use your logic to persuade people, then there's more buy-in. And try to actually get consensus as well. And I'm not saying we should run a company based on consensus seeking, because in the end you need to make a decision. But I think it's always good to actually ask people, what do they think? How would they have done it? And then if there's no consensus or there's broad input from everyone, then you make the call. But then at least everyone felt that they've participated. So the difference between a autocratic leader and a servant leader is the one he accumulates power and make power and exercise that power, whilst your servant leader will actually share his power with the people around him. So I think there's many ways of of just having, but be more humility to you don't have to be, and I think that's what people sometimes see if you look at in politics and in business sometimes. They see people that's very successful, but they're autocratic, they're rough and tough and all of that, and sometimes they try to emulate that because people got in these positions with, you know, with that type of management style. My personal view is that's not sustainable. There's millions and millions of you know, books and literature and of companies where you don't have to be autocratic to actually achieve the best out of your people. And I also, so a good leader will actually focus on culture, and that's, and I think there's an article that's most probably that most people have read by now that's been published a long time by the Harvard Business Review, is that culture eats strategy for breakfast, dinner, and lunch.
Yeah, that's gone far,
Yeah, and that's so true. We're very good as leaders to actually get the strategy in place and all the action plans to execute that strategy. But we actually don't spend enough time on the culture because that's where we actually then fail as a company, because the culture is not conducive to implementing the strategy and all of those action plans, then we will fail. So that's an important thing for leaders to understand.
So let me get a little bit philosophical here. It's interesting. You mentioned the leaders are servant leaders, which is other-focused. And now I want to throw that on its head and say it's difficult for me to be other-focused when I'm not honestly internally confident in myself. If I don't have authentic confidence inside here, then I won't be other-focused. I'll always be me-focused because it's about me and so on. So that internal strength, authenticity, is very important to be able to focus on others. And it's the same with a business, isn't it? If my internal personality, if my internal strength, my culture isn't in place, it's difficult to succeed at the strategy externally. So it's always it's that internal health impacting externally. It's the same. A business is like a person. It's like a personality, isn't it? So the same model. So internal confidence, external execution, external action, other focused. I can focus on my client because I don't have all the nonsense inside my business. My culture is healthy. The business is performing. I can focus on the client. But if it's not, and it's just hell behind me, and it's just pain, and it's debt, and it's just problems behind me, then how can I be customer focused when I'm unhealthy behind me, inside the business? And it's the same with me personally as a leader, same with an organization. Does it make sense?
Yeah, it does. I think and that's why I think as a leader, you need to focus on culture. And the way that I focus on culture as a leader is through my values that we implementing in our organization. And you're totally right. I think we need to focus on the individual as well and build their confidence. And certainly I think in terms of the journey of Edcon, As you know, it's been a very tough journey over the last 10 years. And as leaders, you need to ensure that you keep people resilient and you need to actually come across as confident. You need to come across that you actually believe in the plan. You need to actually celebrate the small successes that's there, to actually just keep people resilient. Otherwise, if the people work hard and you don't see the results, you know, it's very demotivating. So we need to actually get them to actually get up every morning and believe that things will change. And I think that's not unique to our company. I think that's what many companies are experiencing right now in South Africa and all over the world. I mean, the economy is tough, and it's hard to motivate people and to see the big picture and believe in that. I think the other area that I sort of alluded to that before, but it's getting back to culture, is I believe that leaders should be able to inspire people. You know, I know there's different views about some leaders, you know, the charismatic type and the inspirational type, etc. But I do believe if you want to build a good culture, you need to be able to inspire people to a common goal. You need to, they need to feel passionate about what they actually need to do, and that comes from the top. If you're not positive and enthusiastic about what we need to achieve, and you're not inspirational, you're not going to get the staff to really believe in that goal.
Yeah.
That you've actually what you want to achieve for the business.
Jurin, your values are great. You say focused, unconventional, trusted, united, respected, empowered. Those are great values, six of them. They align with the Edcon values.
Yeah.
And but this is more particular to JET. I want us to take one of these, and then you give me a practical way that a sales associate, you call them, on the floor would live it. Because that's always the challenge, is as a leader, I go and I talk to them about the values, and just now you alluded to the fact that you want them to capture the reality of these values, like empowerment. So just give me, grab one and give me a practical example of what you want.
So let's use unconventional as an example. We have communicated to all of our staff, you know, through conferences, and we've cascaded it down. We gave them all the little things that we normally do, to little booklets and little things that they can actually have in terms of explaining what unconventional and trusted actually means.
So the theory is behind.
Yeah. So what we now are busy with, and this is the same process that we've used, you know, 10 years ago. That's why I'm following the same process, is that we're actually building now the behaviors linked to these values. We've given them sort of a broad brush approach of what these behaviors are, and it's not coming from us only, because we had some unions involved, some low-level staff involved, to actually come up with these values, and also with the initial descriptors of those values.
Yeah.
So in stores now, people know that we can't just do things like we're doing it normally. We need to be unconventional in the way that we actually do things. So typically, if a customer is not happy with the size of or can't find her size. Now, in the old days, people will say, well, I don't have it. Mm. And this person will actually then go out of his way to say, well, I'll actually go and find that shirt somewhere else, and I will actually go and drop it off at your home, wherever. Just give me your address. You do things in an unconventional, in a different way. That's the only way to differentiate ourselves from the competitors. Now, the way that we actually then communicate all of this to everyone is that we actually have a nominations committee consisting out of sales associates and management, etc., that on a monthly basis, people can actually nominate people in terms of those six values, where they must clearly say why they nominate these people.
Okay.
What behaviors have this specific individual actually exposed, and in terms of those values. And then as a committee, we actually select the five best ones per value, and we publish that and say, this is what this person did in this store in terms of empowerment. This is the or in terms of any of the other values. So people starting to see what the behaviors are that's actually important in terms of those values. Mm. And then on a quarterly basis, we actually select the top, in terms of the six, the top five out of the monthly nominations.
Okay.
In terms of values. And then we actually, this year, we will actually have then a national award to our staff in terms of the values, because every quarter there are winners. And it's not really about the money for them, it's about the recognition, because we will fly them up from wherever they are, recognize them in terms of those values. But the important thing is that we're building the behaviors actually bottom up, because people send us what they've actually done, and we select that, and then we communicate it back to stores so that they know what we mean by these values. So it's alive all the time. So it certainly worked for us back in the 2000s, and there's no reason why it's not going to work now.
Process.
And it's a very simple process, but it keeps it alive. And people, when you go into stores, they will know the values because we talk about it all the time. We're on the lookout to catch people doing good stuff in terms of the values.
Okay. Jurin, as we start winding down, can you believe it? We've got just a few minutes to go. What has changed that's making it more difficult for leaders to lead successfully? Or has nothing changed?
No, things have changed dramatically. In fact, things are changing too fast at the moment. We can't keep up. In the old days, 20 years ago, you started as a leader with, your SWOT analysis, and you reviewed again a year later. You can't do that anymore. Things are changing at such a rapid pace. So you need, on a fairly regular basis now, what you've decided as your strategy for the year, you actually need to review it almost on a monthly basis now.
It's crazy.
Because that's how, from technology, from everything is actually changing. Competition is faster.
Consumer behavior, thinking, all that.
Yeah, so it's just totally different environments. And then we also have the challenge of the youngsters, the millennials, they've think completely different. And we need to have a different value proposition for them. We need to manage them differently. So I think the environment has become substantially more complex compared to 20 years ago. Obviously, some things makes it easier for us. The technology makes it easier. It's the cell phones makes it easier to a certain extent. But on the other hand, it also makes it more complex. And that's why I actually said in the beginning, you must actually have, to be a leader, you should actually have the desire to be a leader. You need to have the desire to serve, and not just chase the title, because it's not as easy as it looks.
In the past, maybe you can hide the fact that you don't have a desire, and you can act it out, maybe, imitate it. But would you say this highly visible and what's the word I'm looking for? Transparent world we live in forces you to be authentic.
Yeah.
You can't act like you enjoy being the leader. You will be caught out.
Yeah, that's how it works. And I think that's why the whole issue around culture is so important. Mm-hmm. You need to have a proper culture that's conducive to your values that you actually have in the organization, and drive that. Because if you have that good foundation, then the strategy and all of those things will be easier to manage. But you can't fake it, in my view. You won't get away with it, unfortunately.
Dr. Jeroen Ferndale, if you had all your managers from JET standing in front of you, which maybe you can't easily do that because you've spread far and wide, but if you had them, but let's extend the audience. You've got managers and leaders from many other retail stores. In fact, banking. You've got a massive audience of young, up-and-coming leaders in front of you. Is it possible for you to give them one quick message? What must they focus on from here on forward?
Well, there's so many things that they should be doing, and I think that's part of the problem, is there's just so many things to do.
Does it come back to yourself or not?
I think it's... most probably, I think, as I said earlier, I think it's all about what they need to understand themselves as individuals, and they need to have, as I said earlier, that desire to actually be leaders, authentic leaders, and have that desire to actually serve. And if they don't have that, then they should rather stick to a more functional line of doing things. Mm. Otherwise, you will never be happy as a leader if you don't really have a real deep desire to serve and to be a leader. And I'm also on record to say in other interviews that I've done that in the final analysis, you can get a lot of training from universities and all sorts of other places in terms of how to do things, and there's lots of literature on leadership, etc. But in the final analysis, it's also about using your common sense, using your best judgment, because to deal with people, to make business decisions, etc., sometimes not what the statistics actually tell you, or what the books actually tell you. It's about that gut feel. Yeah. That that this is the right decision to make, and that comes with time and with experience.
And interesting, my experience is the more confidence you have, authentic confidence, the more you trust your gut. The less you have of that, the more you just won't go with your gut. That's Dr. Jurin Ferndale, CEO of JET, leading in a very difficult time, but there's a lot of hope and certainly seem to be on the right track. It's been a privilege sitting with you and discussing leadership. Wish we had more time. Maybe we can make another conversation, have another conversation in the near future. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for just making yourself vulnerable and sharing some very interesting wisdom over many years of a very broad and expansive career. We appreciate it.
It was my pleasure, and I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
That's Dr. Jurin Ferndale, as I said. Thank you for joining us for this week's Global Leadership Platform Leadership Masterclass. All the best.
This is CliffCentral.com.